Tonight, Russian and Chinese warships visit Cape Town for multinational maritime exercises. Because I'm a media representative, I managed to actually get an opportunity to visit these ships and be part of the media briefing and get down to harbour several times in the last week. And this is an historic event. Psalm 107 verse 23 declares those who go down to the sea in ships who do business on great waters. And what a privilege to be in Cape Town. As our mission is based in a busy port city of Cape Town, at what William Carey called the uttermost parts of the earth, astride two oceans. I believe we're the only city astride two oceans. The cold Atlantic, the warm Indian Oceans. We often find the mission fields come to us. It's a beautiful port city, but of course, we were called the Cape of Storms before we were renamed the Cape of Good Hope. And we do get storms. We get some serious storms. And waves can overflow our roads on occasion. This is Sea Point, Mooley Point, some pretty serious waves. Some of you may recall all this just 3 years ago. And of course, some parts of the country see this more often. But in Cape Town, we know what it is to have storms. And sometimes, on rare occasions, even lightning. The picture of a Christian's calling is to be a lighthouse in a dark and stormy world to rescue the perishing. Back in 1995, we had over 80 warships, I think it was 89 warships, from many countries of the world. If I remember right, 29 international navies were represented at the 75th anniversary of the founding of the South African Navy. This is quite extraordinary. A South African Navy dated back way back, and so there we were able to see. This is the old Navy. You may recall old President Kruger, President Steyn. These are some of our fine ships, and the Drakensberg. What a lot of stories can be told about ops that they've launched or recovered from there. The Vikings, the Four Reconnaissance Commander, would often deploy from them. We remember the Shackleton and, of course, the helicopters. Just notice again how far up the forests went, Lion's Head and parts of Table Mountain. And, of course, this would be a foreign warship with one of our planes buzzing them to check what's going on. And our Roycutt helicopter and some of our different Navy in the past. Well, in 1995, on the occasion of the 75th anniversary of the South African Navy being founded, we were involved in open-air hymn services and Bible distribution and personal evangelism with sailors at the waterfront. Sailors came from as far afield as China and Pakistan and India and Chile and the United States and Great Britain and Saudi Arabia. It was tremendous. We had countries that are completely close to the gospel in Cape Town, and we were able to be going onto the ships, distributing Bibles. I raided the Bible Society. I went there and managed to get vast amounts of Bibles in Russian and Chinese and in Arabic and all the rest of it. And off we were and contacted our friends in the Navy, and the Naval Band was playing in the amphitheater. And amphitheater, at that stage, you didn't need to book. It was just open. The waterfront only opened a couple of years before. There weren't that many rules. And there was no rules against open-air preaching, and there wasn't anybody stopping us. And we were singing hymns like For Those in Peril in the Sea, and the Navy Band behind, and reading scripture and preaching, and different languages being read out. And we were working around the side and seeing these men with the Saudi Arabian, Pakistani emblems on their hats and giving them Bibles in their language. It was just tremendous. I must say, 1995 in a harbor was a phenomenal opportunity to have the navies of the world come to us. And sometimes we've had other great battleships and warships and aircraft carriers visiting our shores. This here, an Italian Navy aircraft carrier. And we've recently had the Russian and Chinese Navy here too. Sunday the 24th of November 2019 at 13:45, a 21-gun salute was exchanged between the Russian Navy Slava-class missile cruiser, the Marshal Ustinov, and the South African Naval Battery on Lion's Head. Now, the battery overlooks Table Bay Harbor. The battery there's got a long history. The Noonday guns that fire here, these are 18-pounders, which since 1806 have been operational. So these are muzzle-loading artillery, which are the oldest muzzleloaders in existence, still being used regularly. They are used for the Noonday gun, which, by the way, remember, is a call to prayer. It's a call to for people to stop and pray. That's why the Noonday gun was initiated. Initially, it was to set your clocks, but in the First World War, they turned it to a time for people to stop and pray. Remember those who are fighting. Remember those who have died. Thank God for those who survived. Pray for those who are left behind. And the whole origin of a 21-gun salute, you know where this originates, that when a warship, a foreign warship's entering a harbor, they were expected to fire all their guns, powder, without, of course, cannonballs in it, to show that they were empty. It's like the salute is, I've got no weapon in my hand, you know, my right hand's. So that's where it originates from. So 21-gun salute was when you've only got powder and musket, muzzle-loading type weapons, you fired all your guns, it means you're not coming with a hostile purpose. It's going to take time to reload. And so a 21-gun salute from both sides was to indicate friendly intentions. Well, into our harbor came the Marshal Ustinov, and quite an impressive battle cruiser this is. The Russian battle cruiser Marshal Ustinov arrived in Cape Town for an historic international maritime exercise with Russian, Chinese, and South African naval vessels in the South Atlantic. And they said this is the first ever such operation. The cruiser and two support ships that came with their own tanker and with their own rescue tug. I suppose like 61 MEC would go into Angola with recovery and tow vehicles because, you know, if you get into trouble, you want to have your rescue tug. I guess maybe that also makes them independent going into harbors that they don't need to use a local tug. After an almost 5-month, 25,000 nautical mile, that's 47,000 kilometer voyage from its home base in Severomorsk. This is in the Arctic Circle, right up there. This is where they get 6 months day and 6 months night. Arctic Circle. This is on the Barents Sea, and so it's about the furthest northwest you can go in Russia, basically. They would be on the border of Finland and Norway. So there's Norway, there's Finland, here's Russia. That's where Severomorsk is. Now, their touristy type postcard makes it look like a nice, friendly, welcoming type of place. But let me tell you, that's summer. This is what it looks like in winter. And again, it doesn't look too bad, but look closer. Look at these Stalin-era blocks of flats. Ugly as hell blocks of flats. You could just imagine, this is where there's no individuality. You just shoved into these rabbit warrens, I think, as some of the people have called it. And you don't see many houses here. You see primarily industrial-type concrete blocks of apartments. The Americans would call them flats, we'd call them. And, of course, its primary existence is for the Navy. It's the Northern Fleet, they call it. So the flotilla made ports of call in Algeria and in Egypt and in Turkey and Cyprus, the Cape Verde Islands, that's right off the west coast of Africa, and Equatorial Guinea, which is right south of Nigeria and a bit to the west of Cameroon. And they took part in several sea exercises before reaching the South African destination Sunday, the 24th of November, 2019. This is only the third time since the Cold War ended, 1989, that a Russian cruiser's entered the South Atlantic. So in 30 years, this is only the third time we've had a Russian cruiser in the South Atlantic. The first two being the Peter Veliki in 2008 into 2009 and the Moskva in 2015. Table Mountain in the background. Now, if you look at this satellite map, they are that northern light you see. That's about as far north as you can go and still be inhabitable world. And we're about as far south as you go can go to be in the habitable world. So these ships have sailed a long way. And of course, they took a detour in the Mediterranean on the way down here. made quite a lot of ports of call. And again, from this, you can see more like the globe. That's their dot, that light there, and this is our dot, this light here. That's a lot of ocean in between. And remember, while we're in summer, they're in darkness. Imagine 6 months of night up in the Arctic Circle. Not the kind of place I'd want for posting. No wonder they were happy to come to Cape Town. The People's Liberation Army Navy plan, I always thought plan was the SWAPO terrorists, but they also called that in China for their navy. They dispatched Wei Fang, a Type 54A frigate, for joint naval exercises. And this is their frigate. And having looked it over, I don't think it is in any way superior to our South African Navy frigates, which were made in Bremen in Germany and purchased as part of the arms deal, the infamous arms deal. In fact, I would say that our frigates are more modern and better built than this Chinese frigate. But nevertheless, these people are very disciplined sailors. Let me just say that much. And there we are, Table Mountain in the background, the communist red flag of China flying from the bow of this ship. The South African Navy was represented by the Valor-class frigates SAS Amatola and SAS Protea, which are extremely well-made, outstanding frigates. Best of their class, if they're well-run, that is. But, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the construction of them. And so here you had it, to the media briefing, which was on the SAS Amatola. Walked past one nice flag, a beach towel, and some blood-stained communist terrorist regime's rag. A bit disturbing to see the connection. So on the Monday after their arrival, that's last week Monday, I had the opportunity to be part of the media briefing on board the SAS Amatola. This would be the helicopter hangar, effectively, of the frigate. And from the media representation, it looked top-heavy with Chinese reporters. This, of course, is super important for the Chinese central news agency, or Chinese central television, and central is, of course, a communist way of doing things. That big chap in the middle is meant to be the admiral of the fleet of the South African Navy. And you've got the Russian man to his to the right, and the Chinese captain to the left, and the South African captain, who was the captain of the actual coordinating of the operational exercise that would be taking place shortly thereafter. So he gave us the briefing, and this operation they described and explained to us was for world peace and to secure the safety, maritime safety and security in the South Atlantic and all the rest of it. I found very interesting that the Chinese were so well organized that they immediately had Chinese people asking questions in Chinese to the Chinese captain, who gave answers which were translated into English, which sounded like a propaganda camera. There was no individuality, no spontaneity, no anything. It was just morale is high, the ship's crews worked well together despite battling winds and waves the last 3 months. It took them 3 months to get here from China. And, how are we looking forward to this? And we're here for world peace. And it's just kind of like, I couldn't believe anybody could talk like that. But you'd think it's a comedy script.
And the next day when we came to the outreach, we saw this Chinese he was being asked questions and talking. But then there was someone behind, like in front of him, holding a big paper where he was reading from everything that he was talking about.
A script.
Yeah.
Well, and he is very happy to pose for a picture from the, from the stern of the Amatola, and you can see the Chinese vessel right behind him.
Do you maybe know why he has 3 stars on his general?
No, he's a captain, a naval captain. But bear in mind, a naval captain would be equivalent to, in the army, a commandant, lieutenant colonel. A naval captain is not the same as an army captain. But they've got a very different rank structure.
But why did the Russian representative have just 1 star?
It's a totally different rank structure. He's also a captain. Yes, just like if you go to South African Army or the British Army and you see a person's got one star, that means he's a second lieutenant. He's got two stars, he's a first lieutenant. He's got three stars, he's a captain. In America, if you've got one star, you're a brigadier general. You've got two stars, you're a major general, and so on, and goes up to lieutenant general. So three stars for us means a captain. For the American means lieutenant general. So, you know, really, how do you explain all that? So this is now the stern of the SAS Amatola, the South African frigate. And you can see we're just coming out of the helicopter hangar onto the aft deck. According to the South African Navy, this naval exercise is an historic event focused primarily on maritime economic security interoperability. I think that means that you can operate between one another's vessels, landing their helicopters and your deck and your helicopters and their decks, you know, things like that, and maintaining good relations between the participating navies. The theme of the exercise, they told me, was the promotion of safe navigation and maritime economic security. Now, just bear in mind what that means. The Cape Sea Route is one of the busiest, most important naval choke points in the world. Other naval choke points would be Panama Canal, the Suez Canal, definitely in the Gulf of Aden, and Gibraltar. I mean, those would be... But the Cape of Good Hope, even though while it's wide, there's a lot of sea traffic that comes around the Cape. And we were always saying through the Cold War the importance of maintaining the Cape Sea Route for the economic security of Europe and America, of the West, for food, oil, and so many other supplies, not to mention strategic minerals here. And we were betrayed by the West, by the United States of America, State Department, the British Foreign Office, and so on. And they despised the importance of the Cape Sea Route and were happy to hand us over to Marxists who had been trained in Red China and the Soviet Union. And where did they think this was going to go? What did they think was going to be the next logical event? So this maritime exercise has been described as the first such cooperative venture between the Russian, Chinese, and South African navies in the Southern Hemisphere. Next question is why? Why these navies? BRICS. Brazil, Russia, India, China, South America. The BRICS network is basically an economic counter to the Western trade through the dollar. And so what they're trying to do is get an alternative to being bullied by European Union and by the United States foreign policy, that they've got alternatives. And these are big economies. India, Brazil, South Africa, China, Russia, big time, serious. So they're providing an alternative. Now, it's one step from economic cooperation to military cooperation. That's the next logical step. And this is what they're doing. The declared strategic and operational objectives are the development of Russian, Chinese, and South African relations through the reinforcement of multinational exercises. These, by the way, are our South African frigates made in Germany, in Bremen. Training of a multinational task organization to counter security threats at sea, and demonstration of a multinational willingness to ensure regional maritime safety, peace, and stability. What does this mean in normal language? I think it means that we are positioning ourselves, BRICS, in other words, to be able to resist diplomatic, economic, and other pressure or bullying by the West. That Russia has now made an alliance with those who are not part of the American orbit, which includes China, India, Brazil, and South Africa. And think between us. Between Russia and South Africa, you've got virtually all the strategic minerals on Earth. Cape Town sits astride one of the most important sea routes on the planet. And then all the things they've got in the Amazon, which haven't even been discovered yet, massive amounts of mineral potential and so on. India, well, India's just a soaring economy. All sorts of things are happening there. Who knows about China? I don't think that's a good choice, but they're obviously a big economy, mainly because of Hong Kong. Do you know that Hong Kong had a bigger economy than China when Britain betrayed them into the hands of the Red Chinese? So the only reason China's economy soared is because they added Hong Kong's economy to China's. And so it really looks like, wow, China's grown economically. Well, yes, but mostly it's thanks to Hong Kong. Why did Hong Kong do so well? Freedom, free market, no taxes. Anyway, I'm still quoting from these. By the way, these, if you hadn't worked it out, are Russian Navy. The sea phase on the 28th and 29th of October focused on surface gunnery exercises, helicopter cross landings, boarding operations, and disaster control exercise. So they practiced even ships going next to one another and putting the pulley system where they have chaps slide through to the other side and transferring people in stretchers so that they, like casualties who are moving to a hospital ship, and people transferring between one ship and another while the ships are moving, which is actually quite a dangerous exercise. And all kinds of weaponry, which I'll get to in a moment. The Russians have some great toys on board. And I presume they would have had exercise, like, I don't know that this is what they did in this exercise, but this is just an example of previous exercises, to kind of, you find some old vessel and shoot the living daylights out of it. These are Russian aircraft, giving the Russian flags colors. Notice we had the largest supersonic bomber in the world, nuclear bomber, come to South Africa just recently. And that was landing in Vatokloof, the Tupolev 160, I believe, which is colossal, sort of like the size of the Concorde, or bigger. And it flew all the way from Russia with one refueling in flight on the way from Russia. Think of the distance. And then flew back again, just to make a point. This is followed from the Sochi get-together, where Russia did a first ever Africa summit, Africa Economic Summit, where the heads of over 30 African countries went to Sochi, which is in Russia, where they had the Olympics, the Winter Olympics a while ago. And there, Russia launched a whole new economic offensive, basically aid and trade throughout Africa. And it looks like they're moving in, which isn't necessarily bad compared to the alternative being China. But again, it's Europe abandoned Africa. America came in and exploited lots parts of Africa. China is raping Africa. Maybe Russia's going to offer something a bit more balanced. But interesting, these military exercises, air, economics, and now sea. So on Tuesday last week, I was given a guided tour of the Marshal Ustinov, and I took my lovely daughter Daniela along with, because that makes it look so much less threatening. Notice the Chinese vessel just behind. You can see one of the Chinese attack helicopters on the stern of the Chinese frigate. Now, this is Russian script, Cyrillic script. You see, that says Marshal Ustinov in the Cyrillic script. Bill Bathman could read Cyrillic script. It's a different alphabet, and he taught me how to decipher it so that I could read road maps. And you're going in a place like Bulgaria or Russia, and you see, what does that mean? You know, you don't even know the name of, you're trying to get to Sophie or something. How do you even spell that? And so he showed me how to read maps using Cyrillic script, understanding it. Because otherwise you're lost. They don't put it in your alphabet. Then, you know, most of us sort of think, I've just seen some chicken scratch. Marshal Ustinov started being built in 1978. It was launched in 1982, commissioned 1986. So when it's launched, it means the boat's launched. But now they've still got to build all the different components within and the military system. So basically, you're talking about an eight-year operation from starting the operation till the battleship is tested and launched. So this, you may ask, what's the difference between a battleship and a battle cruiser? A battleship is bigger. Well, not necessarily. A battleship and a battle cruiser is normally about the same size, but a battleship's got thicker armor and is slower, whereas a battle cruiser's got thinner armor, but it's faster. So the main thing about a battle cruiser is it's a faster vessel than a battleship. It's got about the same armaments, but its armor is not as thick. So you want to get the enemy before they get you, basically. It's 186 meters long. That's almost two football fields. It's 20 meters wide. It's pretty wide. It's got an 8.5 meter draft. Its displacement is 11,380 tons. Now, if you remember that the German pocket battleships, the Kriegsspree, for example, with 10,000 displacement. So this is not much bigger than the Kriegsspree, for example. So that gives you a bit of an idea of its size, weight. Maximum speed 34 knots, which for a battle cruiser is impressive. Notice these missile launchers on the side of the ship. More about that later. Cruising range 7,500 nautical miles before they need to refuel. That's quite a range. Ship-based helicopter. That's on the stern. You've got the launching pad, and of course there's the helicopter launching their hangar for the helicopter at the back, at the stern too. Now these are surface-to-air missile silos. You'll notice 8 in a pod. And there's 8 of these sections of 8, which makes 64. That's 64 surface-to-air missiles. They said with a range of 100 kilometers. If they told me a range of 100 kilometers, probably longer range. That's pretty impressive. And again, you can see the whole, towards the stern, you've got this massive surface-to-air missile silo site, which is super impressive. Then they've got what they call the Volcano Missile System. We would know it as cruise missiles. Cruise missiles, and they've got 16 of them, 8 aside. A cruise missile is a missile that can go below the radar so you can't see it coming. It can go between buildings, down the street, take the corner, and go and knock right in the door it needs to go to and explode downstairs in the bunker as needed. I mean, literally, it can go down streets and downstairs. That's how precision a cruise missile is. We happen to know the man who designed them, General Ben Parton. General Ben Parton, U.S. Air Force. He said he designed button batteries back in 1950s for cluster bombs. And he also designed the GPS system already back in the 60s to deliver cruise missiles. The whole purpose for GPS is to deliver precision-guided weapons. And that's where the internet came from. The internet was designed that you could send missile launch codes for cruise missiles that no matter what was bombed out, blown out, and so on, it would keep going until it reached its final, like going through a spider's web if necessary. And you could knock out vast amounts of the network, but it would still get there through back doors or whatever. So General Parton designed the cruise missiles back in the 60s, even though they were only starting to use them in the late 80s, early 90s. But these cruise missiles, they said to me, have a range of 500 kilometers. I'm convinced it's more than that. If they admitted 500 kilometers, you can be sure its range is more. And they're big. Each cruise missile, what they call Volcano, is a ton. They can carry nuclear weapons. They don't necessarily carry nuclear weapons, but they can. And so from the side of the ship, you get a bit of a feel for it. Notice there's the Russian flag to the right, but they've got the Southern flag to the left. That is naval etiquette. When you're in the harbor of a foreign port, you fly also the flag of the host country. Notice these weapons on the side. You know what those are? These little turrets with the black barrel with the white caps on top of them, which is just to stop rusts or pigeons going in or something. That's a Gatling gun. These have 6 barrels. In fact, General Ben Parton also pioneered the Gatling gun. The Gatling gun has a rate of fire of 6,000 rounds a minute. They said the distance between each bullet as it's come out, and these are 37 millimeter, which we would have called machine cannon. In the Second World War, some of your heaviest air weaponry would have been a 37 millimeter cannon. That would have been single round, but this is now literally 6 barrels rotating, all shooting. They said there's a 30 centimeter gap between each bullet as it comes out. They call it the saw. The Gatling gun was designed by General Parton particularly in order to bring down aircraft, because take for example kamikaze, Second World War, many of the kamikaze planes were crippled. The pilot was dead and the plane still hit the ship and exploded and sometimes destroyed, sunk and so on the ship. So he devised a system that could cut an aircraft in half, so it doesn't matter what. Wings fall into the ground, aircraft's in half, the plane's going to fall, it's no longer aerodynamic, it can't just keep gliding, there's no it kills the momentum. So the saw Gatling gun is designed to cut straight through metal and basically chop an aircraft in half so that it can't continue on to attack the aircraft, the ship. So that's a primary anti-air close quarter weapon. So these are some of the 16 cruise missiles. Notice they're all numbered. And you can see also an impressive assault in anti-submarine weaponry. These are all anti-submarine. You know, we know the old depth charges. This is the new generation of depth charges. I mean, the ones we know is the ones that are rolled out the back of a ship sort of thing. Well, this goes up, goes down, and they can totally surround wherever a submarine is and do it in such a way that, you know, the old depth charges, they'd rock from this side, then it'd rock from that side, but this will get them from all sides simultaneously. I mean, like no escape. And all kinds of anti-aircraft weaponry. This looks impressive, but it actually isn't there to kill anything. This is what they call anti-heat-seeking missiles, interference. What is it that you disperse? It's basically chaff, like when an aircraft wants to keep away heat-seeking missiles. It sends out... Basically, it's like flares. It's intense heat that would take a heat-seeking missile that's coming in, whether from an aircraft or something else, and make it think it's hit what it's after. So this is interference to... but he gave a proper word, and I've just forgotten right now. But you know what I mean. It scatters, basically, intense heat flares. The artillery systems are the AK-130 and the AK-630. I had no idea AKs went beyond 74, but there we go. We know about the AK-47. We know about the AK-74, which is a lot smaller. And now they've got an AK-130 and an AK-630. Not sure which is which, but this is their biggest weapon on board ship, and this has a phenomenal rate of fire. It can shoot, do you remember what he said? Was it something like, I think it could shoot 8 rounds a minute. This artillery shell, it's something, maybe it was 16, it was very high rate of fire for an artillery piece. Sorry? No, you think you have the Gatling gun. Surely, the Gatling gun was 6,000 a minute. But I don't think an artillery piece could do much more than 8 to 16 a minute. But because the two... At any rate, you wouldn't want to argue with it, basically. It's pretty effective. And there you can just see a bit of Table Mountain in the background. So, here you can see some of the anti-aircraft, some of the anti-aircraft Gatling guns. You can see the anti-submarine weapons, the cruise missiles, and of course the main... artillery weapon in the Marshall Ustinov cruise battle cruiser or cruise missile carrier, as some might call it. And again, you can see the very tiny Chinese frigate next to it. A frigate is primarily for escort duties and for anti-submarine work, but frigates are not to compare with a battle cruiser. So this is from the bow of the ship, and yes, Daniela thought that she could hold a dance workshop on this the bow of the ship quite happily. Some of the sailors showing us around. The sailors either wear black or they wear white, and you notice these are the life rafts. These little life rafts, when once hit the water, spring out into very big rubber dinghy is the wrong word, but they're covered. They've actually got, because you can imagine if you're in the Arctic Sea, it's totally covered from the top, and it's got all kinds of equipment inside. So this is the alternative to the Titanic, where the ship can't sink, so there's no need to have enough lifeboats. And again, you can see how you spell Marshall Ustinov in Russian. And again, it reminds you that battleships and battle cruisers can get sunk, and so you've got to have your rescue vehicles, and this would have not just a light that would activate when it hits the water, but it would have a direction finder as well to help rescue efforts. They've got a nice kind of ship on the side that's sort of for the captain when they get to port and he wants to go off to a port for whatever reason. So they've got some of those, but when it can go alongside the jetty, then that's great. The Marshall Ustinov is part of the Russian Northern Fleet. Notice the phenomenal amount of radar type of equipment they've got here. They've got a very sophisticated communication system. And, of course, they've got the equivalent to what we call the Marines on board. ready to act. And it looks like, this doesn't look like the AK-47s we used to. This must be a new generation of weaponry that they're using. Anyone recognize in particular? I don't particularly recognize it. Must be, it's got similarity to the AK-47, but it's got serious distinctions. It's obviously a very more up-to-date version. Now, this brings to my mind that the Russians weren't always my best friends. And I remember my first mission field, Mozambique, going into Mozambique in 1980s on my motorbike, when it was hardcore communist under this insane Marxist dictator, Samora Machel, who was a pathological murderer who had dedicated his soul to Satan, dedicated himself to destroying the church. He certainly destroyed the economy of Mozambique, and the country went into free fall. You haven't seen Marxism until you've seen what Mozambique was in the 80s. Absolute destruction of a country. They called it the developing world, but the only thing developing was rust. They nationalized the factories. They socialized the towns. Landmines were the national plant. The people literally in rags. People were dying of starvation. We took vitamin-enriched milk, and these children died within the week. It was too late for them. Cannibalism was back. 8,000 churches were destroyed or confiscated. Bibles were burned. Churches were burned. People were massacred. I documented all this in the killing fields of Mozambique. This is a Russian radar site on the road to Chimoio in the Barra Corridor. And when I want to take a picture of that, the Frelimo soldier said, I'm not allowed to. Prohibito. So I asked if I could take a picture of them. Yes, sir. Positioned myself so I could get the radar station in too, just to kind of indicate how they weren't particularly good at their job. But they're holding All Nations Gospel Publishers gospel booklets and scripture gift mission materials. We were just reading to them. Well, Samora Machel's Antichrist policies we've documented, but I saw and took pictures like this of Russian ships taking food out of the country. They brought weapons in, took food out while the people died of starvation. And there's a lot of Russian warships always in Maputo and Barra Harbor at that time. So 1982, I'm in the harbor, and I've got some Russian Bibles, and I think I can just read some Bibles to some Russian sailors. And so I had some Russian New Testaments and Gospels, and I walked down the harbor, and I was handing out to Russian sailors. Of course, not these. I wasn't able to take any pictures. Notice the old Russian Navy ensign, Red Star, Hammer and Sickle. Get back to that just now. Well, I was handing out these New Testaments, and I'd hand out five in a matter of a few minutes. And I was feeling so overjoyed with the success and getting Russian Bibles in the hands of Soviets in the Cold War. This is 1982, and I couldn't have been happier. And suddenly heard this bellow in Russian. And this Russian chap, big chap, bigger than Anthony, came. He picked me off my feet and threw me in the harbor and threw the New Testament on top of me. And someone else came and threw a New Testament down. And I'm in the harbor, which is gungy, oily, gritty, polluted, and trying to find, where is a ladder to get out of here? And just an example of how it wasn't always that easy to hand out Russian New Testaments. That was Maputo. And so, later on, 1989, I was captured by Russians in northern Mozambique and taken in helicopters much like this, MI-8 HIP helicopters, into capture and imprisonment, and all that story is told in the killing fields of Mozambique. So imagine the mixture of emotions for me as I see, as I'm going on a Russian ship this time without being thrown in the harbor, which is very nice, and what's on the stern of the cruiser? A St. Andrew's Cross, which is the ensign of the Russian Federation Navy. They've gotten rid of that Hammer and Sickle Red Star ensign that you saw in the previous picture. And the St. Andrew's Jack flies from the bow of the ship, which is the foremost part of the vessel. The bow is the front, the stern is the back, for those people not Navy. And it almost looks like the Union Jack, doesn't it? It just reversed colors. So you could see, instead of having the red St. Andrew's Cross, they've got the white, the red St. George's Cross, they've got the white St. St. George's Cross. And instead of having the back being blue, they've got the back being red. But it's similar to Union Jack. Just showing again the Christian origins of Russia and the similar Christian heritage along with Europe. Since the early 16th century, the St. Andrew's Cross has been recognized as the national flag of Scotland. The white cross on blue. Notice where's with the Russian Navy now, it's the blue cross on white. But it's the same. It's the St. Andrew's Cross. And the Scottish also have St. Andrew's as their national patron saint. And St. Andrew's also the patron saint of Russia and of the Russian Navy. So in the 18th century, the St. Andrew's Cross became the ensign of the Russian Navy. In the 19th century, the St. Andrew's Cross formed the basis for the flag of the Confederate States of America. And Cape Town is a popular song, Daar Kom Die Alabama, to commemorate when a Confederate battleship, the CSS, Confederate States ship, Alabama, visited in 1863 and 1864. And there's a Confederate sailor buried near Cape Town, actually, who died while in Cape Town. And the Alabama was a spectacular raider. It went around the world, circumnavigated the globe, and it captured or destroyed over 64 Yankee ships. Absolutely spectacular career. But notice their St. Andrew's Cross as part of their naval ensign. Okay, I should say a few words about the Chinese as well. This is the Wei Fang, the Chinese frigate. And interesting, by the way, you notice we walked on board the Marshall Ustinov without any searches, without any encroachments on our personal liberty, feeling welcome. The Chinese had a metal detector, and then all your handbags, cameras, everything else, and whatever's in your pocket had to be abandoned, and the people had to walk on without so much as a camera. You can get a good view of the Chinese vessel from the Russian vessel. Notice the spontaneous support from the local congregation. So it was a welcome, the overseas Chinese and South African friends aboard, and this was just spontaneously on the side of the ship. Communists always seem to have some spontaneous propaganda posters up there. And notice you've got to go through, search, they wandered, took it down, and literally it was leave everything of yours on the table here to go on board. The difference between going on a Chinese ship and going on the Russian ship was just massive. And you can just see again the communist red star, and notice how the naval men are standing. Now, the Russians are very friendly, cheerful, interactive, but yes, there you've got the warmly welcome, the overseas Chinese and so on. And notice these poor souls standing at ramrod. We watched them. It didn't look like they moved in an hour or two, just ramrod straight. And every now and then, officer would come and start pushing them around like they weren't straight enough. And when a person came past, they would indicate, like exit here. And there's no individuality. Our team tried. We failed to distribute a single booklet or New Testament to the Chinese. It's like they were too terrified to take it. The Russians, generally friendly, willing to chat. These are the Namakuras. These are the South African patrol boats which would have been patrolling around the side during the time. But so on Wednesday last week, the South African, Russian, Chinese navies played soccer in Greenpoint. And the Russians, I believe, are the blue shirts and the South Africans are the orange. Is that correct?
Yes.
And
the Chinese wore the white shorts.
Right. And so apparently the Russians won. They won. We're not too sure what happened to the Chinese match. Weren't around for it. But you can see the Chinese are there with the white shorts. Right. Okay. That makes sense. Some of the naval support on the side. So what's interesting about this literature distribution opportunity was Commander Kraling van der Bael, my liaison officer with the South Navy, he commented at the press briefing that we had also offered to challenge a Russian-Chinese guest to a game of rugby, but they gave a firm niet. And everyone there laughed because they're like, who wants to play rugby with the South Africans? So that was nice to see that. There was even the Chinese captain had a smile when he mentioned about the rugby. Now, here are Russian naval ceremony. Interesting bit of history that I wasn't aware of. You might not have been aware of it too. But on the 3rd of May, 1808, Diana, under command of Lieutenant Golovnin, was detained in Simon's Bay by the English fleet. And a year later, on the night of 28 May, 1809, the anchor cables were cut and Diana drifted quietly out of the bay and escaped. So this memorial was erected by the Russian government and Naval Heritage Society to commemorate the event and to pay tribute to Vasily Golovnin and his brave Russian crew. This was erected in 2009 on the 200th anniversary. So interesting that Russia has some little historic link here, that there was a time when they were detained here. So Table Bay is just a wonderful opportunity for evangelistic opportunities. And we're told in the scripture, look also at ships. Although they are so large and driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. And some people say, well, what possible good could distributing a bit of gospel literature to foreign seamen do? Well, consider the power of gospel literature, an example of Mitsuya Fushida. This coming Saturday will be the anniversary of the 7th of December Pearl Harbor attack, and there'll be all kinds of reminders about that. But I'd like to commemorate the power of gospel literature, because Mitsuya Fushida is best known as leading the devastating air attack on Pearl Harbor, 7th December 1941. After the war, Fushida became a Christian evangelist who conducted evangelistic outreaches through Japan, the United States, and Europe. He was the son of a master of the primary school in Kashira, and his grandfather was a samurai warrior. Mitsuya Fushida entered the Imperial Japanese Naval Academy in 1921, graduated as a midshipman in 1924, promoted to ensign 1925, sub-lieutenant 1927. Specialized in horizontal bombing, gained combat experience during the war in China, assigned to aircraft carrier Kaga in 1929. Promoted to lieutenant commander in 1936, accepted the Naval Staff College, joined the aircraft carrier Akagai in 1939, commander of the air group. In October 1941, Fushida was made commander under the command of Vice Admiral Nagumo, with six aircraft carriers and 423 aircraft. Commander Fushida was responsible for the coordination of the aerial attack on the U.S. Pacific Fleet. And if you've seen films like Tora, 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 you've gotten some idea of what was involved. If you've seen Pearl Harbor, you have no idea what happened. Yes, that was a love story disguised as a war film, which was so ahistoric it makes no sense whatsoever. This is the sketch of Fushida on the battleships and which were aflame and how many hits were given, how many torpedoes or how many bombs hit, and so this is his sketch from the air he is surrounding at the time. He was in the first wave of 183 dive bombers, torpedo bombers, level bombers, fighters, which took off from carriers 370 kilometers north of Ohio, targeted the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. At 7:40 Hawaiian Standard Time, Fushida ordered Tenkai, take attack position. He slid back the canopy of his Nakajima Kate torpedo bomber, fired a green flare to signal the attack. He then instructed his radio operator to send the coded signal, to, 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 strike. And they struck. And at 7:53, Fushida sent the code words, Toya, 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 back to the carrier Akagai, the flagship, to report that complete surprise had been achieved, which they didn't expect. Toya was the acronym for Toshuga Ki Rakageki, or torpedo attack, but in Japanese, the first two letters of each word forms Tora, which means, or Toya in their language, meaning tiger. When the attack on Pearl Harbor hit at 7:55 a.m., many American sailors or soldiers were on leave or sleeping late instead of going to church. Seven battleships are lined up on battleship row, like fish in a barrel, target practice, including Nevada, Arizona, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Maryland, California. This is a Japanese aerial photograph of battleship row under attack. You can just see the oil slicks spreading out here and some of the fires that already started. So this is a combat photograph taken from above. The Oklahoma capsized, the West Virginia and California were sunk, the Nevada was damaged and beached near the mouth of Pearl Harbor, almost blocked the entire entrance. Tennessee, Maryland, and Pennsylvania were damaged. 10 other ships were sunk or seriously damaged. The Arizona sank with 1,000 sailors on board after a stupendous explosion of its forward magazine. Just 8 days earlier, the Americans had published a picture of the Arizona battleship with the words, "It is significant that despite the claims of air enthusiasts, no battleship has yet been sunk by bombs." Pride goes before fall. As the first wave returned to the carriers, Fushida remained over the target to assess damage and to observe the second wave attack. He returned to his carrier only after the second wave had completed its mission. 21 large flak holes were found in his aircraft. The main control wires were barely holding together. It's incredible he survived so many hits to his aircraft. He circled the area continuously throughout the entire two-wave attack and survived. The Japanese lost 29 aircraft in the attack on Pearl Harbor. The U.S. Pacific Fleet lost 21 ships, including almost every battleship. 188 aircraft destroyed, almost all on the ground. Another 159 damaged, and 2,400 lives lost. This was the target-rich environment. And these are some of the pictures of the catastrophe afterwards. In Fushida's memoirs, he remarked at being upset at the admiral's cancelling of the third wave attacks, which would have destroyed Pearl Harbor's fuel tanks and dry dock facilities. "I was upset and thought, what stupidity. But the decision belonged to the commander, and it would not do any good if I complained," which wasn't acceptable in their culture anyway. Years later, Fushida wrote that while he mourned those who died aboard the USS Arizona and other ships, he didn't regret his role in the Pearl Harbor attack. "It was war," he said. After a successful Pearl Harbor attack, Fushida was granted an audience with the emperor, which was quite an unusual honor. 19th February 1942, Fushida led the first of two waves of 188 aircraft in an air raid on Darwin, Australia. Well, any city calling itself after Darwin kind of deserves that. On the 5th of April, he led another series of air attacks against Royal Navy bases in Ceylon. June 1942, he was recovering from an emergency shipboard appendectomy, appendicitis removal, when he was wounded at the Battle of Midway. He was on the ship's bridge during the morning attacks by U.S. aircraft, and as a cacao was hit, a chain reaction of burning fuel and live bombs began the destruction of the ship. An explosion threw him to the deck and he broke his ankle. After recuperation, Fushida spent the rest of the war as a staff officer. 2 weeks before the American invasion of Guam, Fushida was ordered to Tokyo. Now, when the Japanese failed to repel invasion, Vice Admiral Kakuka and his staff chose seppuku, which is the samurai ritual suicide of disembowelment, which they would have had to do because he was the grandson of a samurai. This was their code, Bushido, no question about it. "Again, the sword of death had missed me only by inches," Fushida declared. What did it mean? The day before the first atom bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, he was in that city to attend a conference. A long-distance call from naval headquarters required him to return to Tokyo. As he ate breakfast in Yamato, 200 kilometers away, Fushida learned that everyone he'd been working with in Hiroshima had perished in the atomic explosion. The day after atomic bombing, he was sent back to Hiroshima to assess the damage. All the members of Fushida's party died of radiation poisoning, but Fushida exhibited no symptoms. Each of his officers who had accompanied Fushida to investigate the devastation in Hiroshima showed strange signs of illness. One by one, they died through what we now know was radiation poisoning, but they wouldn't have known that then. As Fushida returned to Kashiwahara to help his wife raise their children, he was depressed. Life had no taste, no meaning. "I'd missed death so many times, and for what? What did it all mean?" After the war, Fushida was called to testify at the trials of Japanese military leaders. When General Douglas MacArthur summoned Fushida to testify on the Tokyo war crimes trials, Captain Fushida expressed his disgust, declared that everyone should know that war was war, and cruel acts occurred on both sides, like the atomic bombs. Tojo, the general in charge of the Japanese army, was hung, along with hundreds of others. The petty vindictiveness of the Allies infuriated him, and he denounced the victors' justice. In 1947, he met his former flight engineer, Kazuo Kenan Gasaki, who he had thought had died in the Battle of Midway. However, Ken and Garcia report that a young Christian woman, Peggy Covell, had cared for them in the prison camps, despite her missionary parents having been killed by Japanese soldiers on the island of Panay in the Philippines. Peggy Covell's parents were missionary teachers in Japan till 1939, so they spoke the language. Then they were relocated to the Philippines. The Japanese conquered the Philippines in 1941. They beheaded both of Peggy's parents on Sunday morning, 19 December 1943. To Fushida, this love for your enemies was inexplicable, as the Bushido Code required revenge against the murder of one's parents to restore one's honor. He became obsessed with trying to understand why would anyone treat his enemies with such kindness and forgiveness. The extraordinary example of Peggy Covell and Jacob de Chazor inspired Fushida to know more about the God of the Christians. When Japanese prisoners of war asked the young 18-year-old Peggy Covell why is she volunteering to help them, her reply was, because Japanese soldiers killed my parents. When Peggy considered her parents' sacrificial service for the kingdom of God and their love for the Japanese people, she was convinced that she must continue their mission of reaching Japanese for Christ. As Fushida researched from every source in the Philippines that knew the Covells, he learned they'd been forced to their knees by their captors. They'd prayed together as they were about to be beheaded. And what were they praying for? They're praying for the Japanese. In 1948, as Fushida was passing by the bronze statue of Hachiko, some of you maybe know the story of this incredible dog who waited at the train station for years after his master died, because he had greeted him at the train station back from work every day. And he was there. So they've got a statue remembering this loyal dog. By that statue, he was handed a pamphlet about the life of Jacob de Chazor, a member of the Doolittle bombing raid, who was captured when his B-25 bomber ran out of fuel in occupied China. In the pamphlet, "I was a prisoner of Japan," de Chazor, a former U.S. Army Air Force Staff Sergeant and bombardier, related his testimony of imprisonment, torture, and awakening to God. In the pamphlet, "I was a prisoner of Japan," de Chazor, former U.S. Air Force Staff Sergeant, relates his testimony of imprisonment, torture, and awakening. Jacob de Chazor was the bombardier of the B-25 number 16. There were only 16 of these B-25s who took off from that aircraft carrier on that raid. After taking off the USS Hornet, dropping bombs on Nagoya, Japan, they flew to China but ran out of fuel over Japanese-controlled China, failing to reach nationalist China, which was their goal. This is the first time any such bombers were attempted to fly off an aircraft carrier. It was considered impossible, but they did it. And it was to make a point and to provoke the Japanese, which actually led directly to the Midway turning point of the war. But that's another story entirely. And Captain Michener with Lieutenant Colonel Doolittle, how they got these bombers off that aircraft carrier, and they knew they couldn't land them again. They could launch them, but they could never recover them again. So they had to fly into China. Chances of them not being captured was slim. So it was something like a suicide-type mission. But an historic attempt. You can see at the range that they launched, and then they had to get to China, and they didn't make it to the... Most of them didn't make it to the nationalist-controlled areas. And so... here they are in China. This is Lieutenant Colonel Doolittle. He did make it to the nationalist areas and was able to return to the war. But de Chazor was captured after parachuting to the ground, imprisoned for 40 months, 34 of these months in soldier confinement, beaten, malnourished, saw three of his crew executed by firing squad. The fourth member died of starvation. After 25 months of hating his captors, a Bible came into his hands for only 3 weeks. But it changed his life completely. He began to learn Japanese and to treat his captors with respect. He resolved to bring the message of Christ to Japan. And after returning to the United States, de Chazor attended Seattle Pacific College, returned to Japan to preach the gospel. After 40 months as captives, three of the four surviving American prisoners, noticeably emaciated, arrived at Chongqing, China, late August 1945. From left to right, Jake de Chazor, then Bob Height and Chase Nielsen. here's de Scheza preaching in Japan, and you can see the bomb-scarred base of a statue directly behind him. De Scheza and his wife. He established a church in Nagoya, the very city he had bombed years before. Fushida became intrigued with the Christian faith. The shocking examples of Christians able to forgive their enemies staggered Fushida. That's when I met Jesus. Looking back, I could see now that the Lord had laid his hand upon me so that I might serve him. Fushida read a tract on the spot that's right by the statue of Hachiko, the loyal dog. And on the train, he saw an advertisement for a book with the same title. When he disembarked, he hit for a bookstore and he bought this book, The Amazing Story of De Scheza, of course in Japanese. De Scheza's story engrossed Fushida. Determined to understand what had motivated De Scheza, Fushida bought a Bible from a Japanese man selling them on the street. When he read, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing," Fushida realized this must have been what the Cobbles had been praying before the execution. In 1949, Fushida purchased a Bible at the same railway station where he had received the pamphlet, where this faithful dog had waited for years. As he read the Gospels, he came to understand the reason for the life of forgiveness and mercy that motivated Peggy and Jacob. It was the crucifixion of Jesus and his words in the Gospel, "Forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing." So on the 14th of April, 1950, Fushida surrendered to Jesus Christ as his Lord and Savior. By the time he had completed reading the Gospel of Luke, he had become a Christian. He knew no Christians, but now he began to declare himself to be a Christian. As Christianity was considered to be the occupation religion of the enemy in Japan, this brought him a lot of reproach from his former friends and family, as you can imagine. Peach and Glenn Wagner of the Pocket Testament League of Japan met with Fushida and encouraged him to join them for an open-air outreach. In the business section of Osaka, as the Americans stood to speak, fewer than 40 Japanese would stop to listen. But when Fushida, the hero of Pearl Harbor, was introduced, the crowd swelled rapidly. Rush hour traffic stopped. Hundreds gathered. Even the police listened in. This was the beginning of Fushida's new career as an evangelist. Soon he filled an auditorium in Osaka. 500 Japanese came forward at that rally. Almost every newspaper in Japan reported on it. He described his conversion as like having the sun rise. He preached against Japanese egocentrism and xenophobia. Like Paul on Mars Hill, he used Japanese cultural examples to communicate the gospel of Christ. He was known as God's samurai. Captain Fushida went from being a vital part of Japan's military attack on the United States to being a vital part of God's missionary offensive into the hearts, minds, and souls of Japanese, and later Americans and Europeans too. In May 1950, Fushida and De Scheza met for the first time. In May, he visited De Scheza, knocked on his door, and said, "I've desired to meet you, Mr. De Scheza. My name is Mitsuo Fushida." And of course, any American aviator knew that name. De Scheza recognized the name, said, "Come in, come in." And the former enemies embraced as brothers in Christ. In 1951, Fushida published an account on the Battle of Midway, the battle that doomed Japan and the Japanese Navy. In 1952, he toured the United States as a member of the Worldwide Christian Missionary Army of Sky Pilots. I remember the thrill that was mine when in one of my first meetings I led the first soul to Christ in America, and he was one of my countrymen. In February 1954, Reader's Digest published Fushida's story on the attack on Pearl Harbor. Fushida wrote, "From Pearl Harbor to Golgotha," which was later renamed from Pearl Harbor to Calvary. A 1955 expansion of his book, Midway, the Battle that Doomed Japan, the Japanese Navy story. And then he wrote his autobiography for that one day, The Memoirs of Mitsuo Fushida, Commander of the Attack in Pearl Harbor. That was published in Japan, though, only in 2007, translated into English and published in 2011. It is said that the reason for a state to nurture its soldiers for years is to use them for just one day. My entire youth was dedicated for that one day. He's talking about the day of battle in Pearl Harbor. Although he recognized that there was a higher call In Midway, the battle that doomed Japan, Fushida wrote, 5 minutes. Who would have believed that the tide of battle would have shifted in that brief interval of time? The Battle of Midway is an extraordinary story. We had been caught flat-footed in the most vulnerable position possible, decks loaded with planes armed and fueled for attack. The Battle of Midway, I mean, it was a complex operation with all kinds of intelligence on both sides and feints and every kind of deception involved. Both navies were trying to trap the other one, and it turned in an instant on a whole series of amazing events. Fushida turned down an offer from the Japanese government to organize the new Air Force. He faced down an angry pilot who pulled a knife and threatened to kill him, but that man later came to Christ. Here he is at Pearl Harbor 1966, pointing to where he led the Japanese planes in the attack. He ministered in prisons, led people to Christ, even in prison cells of condemned murderers. He formed Calvary clubs in prisons. Mitsuya Fushida relates the testimony of Peggy Covell and her brave parents all over Japan. He quoted a testimony, "But the Holy Spirit has washed away my hatred and has replaced it with love." The Covells had gone to the death singing hymns joyfully and praying for the conversion of the enemies. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Mitsuya Fushida is one of the fruit of their faith. So you see the power of prayer, you see the power of martyrdom, you see the prayer of courageous Christian testimony, and the power of gospel literature. Fushida spent the rest of his life as an evangelist, taking the gospel of Christ throughout Japan and the United States of America and to Europe. So this 7th of December, as we remember Pearl Harbor, let's also remember to pray for Japan and to pray for the power of gospel literature to make its impact, to reclaim our communities for Christ, to take the opportunities when foreign naval vessels or foreigners come into our area. The opportunities for evangelism are just all around us, and it's just so absolutely vital. We don't just exist to minister to people far away in Sudan, which is super important, but to minister to people close by. And what we can do to bring people back to the Word of God, if one man like Mitsuya Fushida could get transformed by the gospel, I just wonder what God's plans could be for some of those Russian sailors that came past our port. So we've got Biblical Worldview Summit coming up to train people. We've got a Great Commission course coming up. We want to get people back to the Bible, to see the mission field all around us, to climb mountains, to get a new vision, to be able to get a different perspective from the tops of mountains, and to be able to recognize that discipleship is like climbing mountains. You get a different perspective. You see things the average person doesn't see. And what's the vision continually in Pilgrim's Progress? Ever onwards, upwards, higher, deeper in. That's also Narnia as well. And so pray for upcoming Great Commission course and for the potential in the outreaches that are coming up. Just a few interesting perspectives you don't always see. To get above the clouds. To see our town, our city, as most people down below don't see. You know, most people in Cape Town have never climbed Table Mountain. Do you know most Christians have never witnessed for their faith? Do you know most Christians have never led someone to Christ? And yet, think about it, that every light down there represents several people. There's millions of souls just in Cape Town. The opportunity for evangelism is all around us. And not just with our people, but if we just take a mountain goat's perspective and get up high and get an eagle's eye view of the mission field, we will get an idea of what God wants done and recognize an opportunity. Like the Russian and Chinese vessels coming to town. Okay, I don't think we succeeded at all with the Chinese. Not for lack of trying, but they are terrified too. They obviously have been ordered not to take any gospel literature, the fact that we couldn't get anything from them. But this is spiritual warfare. But just think of the world around, and here we are, uttermost parts of earth, as William Carey called it, at the gateway to two oceans, an amazing opportunity and privilege we have, not only of taking the light of the gospel throughout the continent of Africa, but through our literature, maybe even as far as the Arctic Circle.